I'm kind of glad that it's a house that we rent, not a house that we own. There are lots of good things about home ownership, but for this, I'm like, yeah, if I see more cracks, I'm going to be more happy that this isn't mine. But foundations are necessary and they're purposeful. They have to be there. You need them, but they're there to accomplish something. A building with a weak foundation has its consequences. You choose to put up and erect a building and you don't spend the requisite time, energy, money, materials on the foundation, and you have consequences. Some of them are humorous and historical. Some of them are not. So if you don't have the right foundation, things can quickly fall apart. But here's the thing. If you have a really great foundation and you don't put anything on top of it, what you have essentially is a really nice hole in the ground. A hole that's squared up, a hole rectangular, square, who knows, whatever the dimensions of the building were supposed to be, covered in cement, whatever. Stan can fill you in more on that and what you do with a foundation. But basically, you have a hole. Something is intended to go on top of that foundation. And spiritual foundations are the same way. You don't have a good basis. You don't have a good groundwork for your spiritual life. It will fall apart. But the groundwork and the foundation are there so that something can be built on top of it. And that's what I want to be tackling tonight as we look at this account in the life of David, talking about the spiritual foundation that we have, and then talking about what's supposed to be happening on top of that spiritual foundation that's been laid, hopefully, through our understanding of God through his word. So let's read together. I'll read, you read along in your mind. Then it happened when David, I'm in 1 Samuel 30, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire. And their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he said to them, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor, remained behind. Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, and gave him bread, and he ate, and they provided him water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Kerethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. Then David said to him, will you bring me down to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band. When he had brought him down, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and all the cattle which the people drove ahead of the other livestock, and they said, "This is David's spoil." When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, then David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart." Then David said, "You must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." So it has been from that day forward that he made a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, "Behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to those who were in Bethel, and to those who were in Ramoth of the Negev, and to those who were in Jatir, and to those who were in Aroer, and to those who were in Sifmoth, and to those who were in Eshtemoah, and to those who were in Rakal, and to those who were in the cities of the Jeremelites, and to those who were in the cities of the Kenites, and to those who were in Hormah, and to those who were in Borashan, and to those who were in Atak, and to those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go." So what's our foundation, as we've been talking about that getting started here tonight? Our foundation is that God is fundamentally, unfailingly trustworthy. And there are no circumstances that we can face that can overwhelm his capacity to deliver. See, when we say that God is trustworthy, we're not just saying that he's nice, that he wants to keep his promises, that he has integrity, he doesn't like to go back on his word. We're also saying that he has the power to effect what we need, that he can do the things that he's promised, that he can act in our lives, not only that he's willing to, but also that he's able to. And we see from this text tonight evidence that there are no circumstances that can overwhelm God's capacity to deliver. Nothing can back him into a corner and says, "Oh, I don't know what to do for these people. Oh man, this is a big situation. This is a tall order. This is above my pay grade. I can't handle it." That's not God. David and his men have returned to a desolate ruin. Do you remember where they were coming from? They were coming from the muster of the Philistines who were preparing to go up to Israel, to Jezreel, to fight against Saul and his army. And they had mustered together here in Aphek. And when David and his men, remember last week we talked, the Philistine lords, God providentially provided a way for David to get out of this battle with his own people. When the Philistine lord said, no, he's going to pay for the favor of Saul with the heads of these men, send him back. He and his men took 3 days to come back down here to Ziklag. I apologize for the resolution. I like the map. It has what I need on it, but it's just the resolution is just a little bit under there. But they're coming back to Ziklag, 60 miles perhaps, and they split it up into a three-day march. And at the end of the third day, when they come back expecting to be welcome to hearth and home, they find everything burned and everyone gone. Now, having everyone gone seems on its face better than finding the ground strewn with the corpses of their families. At least we have hope that they might still be alive. But being taken by their enemies, the Amalekites, is not a reassuring thought. It was interesting. Some of the commentators said it's possible. David had made raids while he was living in Philistia, while he was living in Ziklag. He had gone out to raid others, and some of the people he raided were the Amalekites. So some people were saying this is retribution. This is a retaliatory attack from the Amalekites on Ziklag, and they waited for an opportune time when they could come in and not be opposed. We're not sure about that, but it's possible. But it's not a comforting thought that these people are all gone. David also is not immune. His wives have been abducted also. Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess to whom he was married. And remember, Michal, his first wife, the daughter of Saul, for whom he paid 100 foreskins of the Philistines, she's been given away by Saul to somebody else, Palti of Laish, I believe. So he doesn't have her, he doesn't have Ahinoam, and he doesn't have Abigail, the one he married after Nabal died, the Abigail that had come out and kept him from going and destroying Nabal's whole household when Nabal insulted him. So all his wives are gone too. I don't know if I have an earthly fear greater than my children being taken away from me so that I can't protect and care for them. That doesn't mean I want my wife to be taken away from me, but I look at my wife as a competent adult who's able to defend herself, who would know how to think in a situation. But when I think about my kids, that's the kind of thing that could keep me up at night. That's the kind of cold chill that passes over my body. And here we have this 600-fold. Dale Ralph Davis in his commentary rightly names this chapter "When the Bottom Drops Out." And you gotta look at this, because war and its consequences are talked about so often in the Bible. And a lot of times it's talked about in a fairly matter-of-fact way. The Bible sometimes employs great economy of language, where sparing words. Hey, this is they went up, they defeated, they went down. You don't think about necessarily what you see in the movies, the people writhing and rolling around on the ground and groaning and in pain. But you have to get into this. And what brings it home, it's, again, battles from the Bible don't always hit us in this kind of visceral way, but we have clear evidence here that the ancient peoples who fought these wars, who fought these battles, were not removed from the emotional consequences. What does it say here in verse 4? "Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep." They cried out everything. Have you been there in your life when you've been so distressed over something that you've cried and you've cried and you've cried, and then eventually you get to the point where there's nothing left? You have a blinding headache. You're still sad about whatever happened, but you have no more tears to give. And here are these mighty men, these warriors that surrounded David, and we find them weeping their eyes out over the loss of their families. This hurts. This hurts badly. And those of us in here have faced and will face devastating circumstances. I'm never going to be able to understand or to know all of the painful circumstances that those of you who are listening to this have been through, or the ones that you will encounter. But I started to do a taxonomy in my mind, just go through a list of some of the things that I've been aware of. All in this body, some very recently, have had death claims one that they love. Some of you have buried children. Some of you have faced or are facing devastating and chronic challenges to your health. Things that are debilitating, things that trouble you, things that affect your faith as you try to figure out. I'm not saying that in a negative way, but just how do I deal with this in my relationship with God? Some of you are troubled for loved ones who have made choices you know they'll deeply regret, and they're choices that you are suffering for or will suffer for also. You're going to walk through at least some of this pain with them. Some of you are struggling with questions about your faith, struggling with desires you don't understand, temptations that thwart your best efforts to do right. Some of you have been betrayed in the deepest and most hurtful ways imaginable. Some of you have seen lean times when it comes to financial provision. And all of you inhabit a sinful, fallen world that has no shortage of crises to fling at you. It's very easy here to adopt the words of Wesley, the Dread Pirate Roberts. Life is pain. Anyone who tells you differently is selling something. And David's pain is compounded as he receives the blame for what happened. His men in their distress over the loss of their loved ones and their possessions, over this absolute devastation, see David as a lightning rod, and they're talking about stoning him. He's become this focal point for the grief-laden anger of his men. Look here in verse 6. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. Bitter people are an inconquerable army in themselves. You know what happens with bitterness? Your pain co-opts your sense of justice. Your pain makes you feel completely justified. All this has been done to me. I have no responsibilities anymore to anyone in my life but to take out the bitterness that I have inside. Now, I don't think she was here, but you remember back to the story of Ruth and Naomi. I don't think Naomi was in this place, but remember when she came back to Bethlehem, said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." Why do you call me Naomi? Which means pleasant. Mara means bitter. It's the root that we get this word that's used in here, embittered. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. When she lost her husband and her two sons in the land of Moab, she came back understanding what bitterness felt like. And it's evidence of our absolute moral ruination as a race that we will compound and extend the pain that has already exploded like a bomb in our midst by flinging the caustic acid of blame at the people who are sharing our suffering. This is terrible. It just came to my mind. I heard about a family a long time ago. They had given their baby too much Tylenol. It was really an expose on how doctors aren't recommending right amounts of painkillers. And so they said, "Should we give them this much?" They're like, "Oh, give them that much." And they're like, "Well, it says less." "Oh, yeah, fine, whatever." And the baby died. And so they couldn't stay together after that. And I don't think they were necessarily blaming each other, but they just couldn't look at each other. I'm like, man, when people need each other the most, this pain is driving them apart. So this is intense. This is a circumstance that is devastating, but it cannot overwhelm God's capacity to deliver. David has a rock to which he can run. So he turns and he inquires of the Lord. And he receives from God in this moment clear instruction and an unqualified promise. The instruction, pursue. Go get him, David. The promise, unqualified, for you will surely overtake them and you will surely rescue all. In his deep distress, God gives to David the gift of hope. As bad as things are, as horrible as this, you came back expecting your favorite meal and you found your wife and your kids gone and your house burned. You had nothing. And as bad as things are, there is a rescue in the making. And God's ability to deliver is not dependent on resources that we can count. It's not our ability to do the mental math. And, well, this is what I bring to the table. This is what I know other people can help me with. I think we got enough to get through this. God isn't waiting for you to finish your calculations before he decides to intervene. Hot on the heels of the Amalekites, David's forces reach the brook Besor. quite possibly the modern Wadi Gaza. About 12 to 15 miles, one of the commentators, Bergen, said maybe 16, from Ziklag. So that 12 to 15 miles, there was a VBS where I locked my keys in my car, and I left my ignition on, and my battery died. And at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was done cleaning up sets and props, I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? Well, I'm not calling anybody. I know there are people I could call. I know you would welcome me. I know you would welcome a phone call from me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I know you're dying for that to happen. And I could have called AAA, but you know, I didn't really think about it, so I filled up my canteen, and I grabbed a box cutter for protection, and I walked home. And I made it. I almost made it home. About 7 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from my wife. Are you okay? Are you still at church? Did you sleep there? What happened? I made it 11 miles. And I was tired. I was. You know what I was doing? I was counting the turns. I had my whole route mapped out in my head when I walked out that door and said, okay, I'm going to turn onto this road, I'm going to turn on this road, and it's 625, and I'm going to turn here. And I was figuring out the shortest distance, and I counted, and every turn, I was like, okay, that's 16 more turns to go. That's 15 more turns to go. And I got to a place where there's usually a spring flowing, a little pipe comes out, and there's usually water coming out, like all the time. Every time we pass it, every time we come to church, there's always water. There was no water that day. So by then, I'm like, okay, I can have one more sip from my canteen. Anyway, enough about me. But just a minute, 12 to 15 miles they've pursued, which I imagine is a pretty urgent pace when you're pursuing people that have your kids. I don't think you're sauntering. I think that's more of at least a jog, maybe double timing it, I would think. And what have they done before that? Well, they've cried themselves out of tears, and which they said this is an exhausting experience. And before that, they took a march of 60 miles in 3 days. So it's understandable that some of these guys were just at the point where they couldn't go on anymore, and 200 of them remain behind. It's kind of reminiscent of what happened to Gideon when he went up against Midian. Gideon, Midian, they rhyme, that's easy to remember. Now that was very deliberate. God kept deliberately whittling down his force. Hey, if anyone's afraid, let them go home. Hey, if they just bend down and start drinking out of the stream and not cupping it in their hand and drinking, send them home. So it gets down to like 300 at the end. That was God doing it deliberately. But here we have something very similar through natural means, we'll say. So we're here. Again, we've come from Ziklag. We've done our 12 to 15 miles down here to Besor. And this is where 200 of them say, we're done. We can't go any farther. And we know the force that David's going up against, the Amalekite band that had raided Ziklag and had burned it, we know, if we look ahead in the text, sorry, 17. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man escaped except, how many? 400 young men who rode on camels. So this is a great victory, and 400 people got away. How many people does David have? Four, at this point, now the 200 are based, or he has 400. So as many people escaped as David's total force. So we imagine that the Amalekite force that he was up against was much larger than his, if 400 of them could just kind of get away on their camels. So David's up against serious forces, and he doesn't have even his full complement of soldiers at this point. Our faithlessness leads us to only see the resources that we can bring to the table when we're dealing with the devastating circumstances in our lives. And again, there's nothing wrong with reckoning with realities. It's okay to take stock of where you're at and what's going on. But if we're only going to account for what we can muster to face the challenges of life, our emotional fortitude, our financial provision, our ingenuity, our innate wisdom, if that's all we're going to lean on when we face the challenges of life, we will always, always come up short. God, in all his greatness and his grace, must always fill in the rest of the equation. And God's providence, we talked about that last week, his providence is ever ready. Last time his providence was very silent, this complaint on the part of the Philistine lords that forced Achish to send David back because he didn't want to make a fuss in the middle of the camp. He didn't want to upset the wrong people. We saw God's providence working there, and it's working here as well. Now, I mentioned last week a passage from 1 Chronicles, and I'd like to visit it again. It's an excellent little parallel passage to the one that we're looking at. Would you turn in your Bibles to 1 Chronicles 12:19? 1 Chronicles 12:19, and we read, verse 19 talks about what we dealt with last week, from Manasseh also some defected to David when he was about to go to battle with the Philistines against Saul, but they did not help them, for the lords of the Philistines, after consultation, sent him away, saying, at the cost of our heads, he may defect to his master Saul. So that was last week. We had this this group from Manasseh that had come to join David right before he went up, and then David was sent back. But listen to verses 20 and 21. As he went to Ziklag, there defected to him from Manasseh Adnah, Jozabad, Jediel, Michael, Jozabad, Elihu, and Zilithai, captains of thousands who belonged to Manasseh. They helped David against the band of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor and were captains in the army. So apparently, before David pursues these raiders, the Amalekites that have destroyed his town and have taken his wives and the families of his men, these men come down from Manasseh. And the number doesn't change. When the Bible accounts for the number of David's force, it doesn't expand. He had 600 men when he first went down into Philistia a year and 4 months earlier. He has the same, the Bible says he has the same 600 now, but these men from Manasseh are among them. And so it doesn't look here that they were enough to add so much numerically, but what they brought to the table was battle-hardened experience. These were military men, these were mighty men of valor, these were captains in the army. So as David's going to pursue the Amalekites, even though he has to leave 200 men behind at Besor because they're too tired to go on, he has with him, we assume, these other leaders who can help organize his forces, who can help direct them into battle, can inspire their confidence. So God has provided for him these defectors who are tired of Saul, want to follow David, and have come all the way down from Manasseh to join him in his exile. And then God provides a very unlikely scout. After they leave the men behind at Besor, in verse 11, now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread and he ate. They provided him water to drink. So they have to restore him because he's gone 3 days and three nights without water and without eating anything. And he's there because he was left behind because he got sick. And as David asks him and inquires, and the commentator said probably from the beginning, David was, you know, wasn't just being nice to him. He was wanted to get information out of him, so they got to get the guy back to like at least the point where he can be conscious and talk and, you know, carry on a conversation. So they take care of him, but they're going for something here. They have an agenda. Again, according to the scholars who were looking at this. But he says, so where are you from? And he tells him, I was with these Amalekites. Hey, I'm the guy that burned down your village. I don't know at this point if he knows who David is, but he said, I was with them. We made these raids, and then I was left behind. Talk about one man's trash being another man's treasure. The heartlessness of David's enemies treating a man like a used tissue is going to be God's way of bringing David swiftly down to the Amalekites, as he says to this Egyptian, hey, will you take me down to them? Yep, swear that you won't kill me. Swear that you won't hand me back to my master who doesn't care enough about me, left me by the side of the road for dead, and I will take you down. Dale Ralph Davis would push it so far as to suggest that finding the Egyptian was an absolute necessity for David's mission to succeed. I'm not sure if that's totally the case, but I certainly agree with what Bergen says, that the Egyptian was David's best hope, one that apparently had been sent to him by the providential hand of God. And what's amazing, too, is incidentally, David and his men meeting this Egyptian not only gives them the information and the guide that they need to get to the people they're pursuing to get their families back, but it's life for the Egyptian as well. God is taking care of the Egyptian through David, even as the Egyptian is providing the information that David needs. As we pointed out last week, God is working, and he uses many different instruments to accomplish his purposes. Some of those instruments we know and recognize very readily. We see them coming, but the depth of his provision is so great that it utilizes instruments we never would have anticipated, Look back over your life and see the ways that God has moved you, taught you, brought people into your life, took people out of your life, done it. And some of these things you didn't want at the time that they were happening, but they brought you into the place that you needed to be. And none of it is something that you could have designed. None of it is something that you could have come up with on your own. It had to be the providence of God. Dale Ralph Davis rightly observes, "It seems that the doctrine of Yahweh's providence is ubiquitous." Means it's everywhere in 1 Samuel. We seem to meet it everywhere. And of course, we meet it everywhere because it is there. God is constantly providing for David throughout this time. And then God gives victory and turns evil to good. David and his men find the Amalekites partying just a little bit too soon. It was a little bit premature to break out the cask of wine or the keg of ale or whatever they were imbibing and to start dancing around with the spoil that they had gained. He finds them in the perfect state, spread out, not in battle readiness, I assume debauched and inebriated. Tzumora points out that the language that's used here could actually point to a dawn raid that had been most likely to prevent injury to the families of David and his men and to keep Amalekites from escaping. But whatever the case, the victory is completely decisive. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except, as we saw, 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. And David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives, but nothing of theirs, verse 19, was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. I kept thinking of the Grinch. He brought everything back. So David had captured, and then we go beyond that. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock, and they said, "This is David's spoil." So the Amalekites were raiding. They had raided Ziklag and took everything from there. They had raided the Negev of the Kerethites, seemed to be Philistine allies who were near the coast, who actually were like Cretan in origin. And they had also raided the Negev of Caleb. You remember Caleb, the faithful spy, and he was awarded Hebron in the land of Judah. He was a Judahite, and he was awarded that and the land around that. So they had raided all these places. They had taken it. Well, now David gets all of that. David gets all that spoil. He went from losing everything to gaining everything back, and then more besides. He's been, actually, in the end of this, he's been enriched by this encounter. God's promise is fulfilled. David brought it all back. Remember, some Amalekites escaped. The promise was not that David would kill every single Amalekite. The promise was that he would overtake them, and he would rescue all. That's what God had said, and that's what God did. Lock, stock, and barrel. And from the spoils that he's taken, he's able to distribute them to the cities and the towns of Judah. It's way too long and too intimidating to go through in detail, but from verse 27 down to 31, it describes all the places in southern Judah that David sent presents from the spoil that he had taken. Just note there, Bethel is not the Bethel where Jacob fell asleep and saw the ladder. That's in Ephraim's territory. This would have been an unknown Bethel down in southern Judah. But all these towns, he sends them out, and he's feathering his nest for when he's going to become king. Because you know, we're going to get to 2 Samuel, Lord willing, eventually, if he spares my life and I continue to be able to do this, we're going to get to 2 Samuel. When David is actually made king, he's not made king of all Israel. He rules in Hebron, which is in this list. He rules in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months. 7.5 years, he's only king of Judah until his reign is finally consolidated. But God takes one of the most devastating experiences of David's life up to this point and uses it to prepare him for his future role in God's kingdom. Just a quick look here, some of the places. Like I said, we can't go through them all, but there's Hebron. These are A lot of these are guesses. A lot of these we don't actually know where they are, but a lot of them were measured in distance either from Beersheba or from Hebron. So we have possible site of Eshtemoah, Jatir, we have Ramoth in the Negev, Hormah, Borashan. So he's sending these gifts out to the cities of Judah. A lot of them are Levitical cities. A lot of them are priest cities. And we know that David had a place for the Levites. He had a desire for worship. He had a desire to build the temple. It's also a very important element in Israelite society. You want to be welcomed by the priestly class. Very much a Romans 8:28 situation. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And I'm sorry if that verse seems overused. We use it a lot. Do you know why we use it a lot? Because it's beautiful. It's a beautiful declaration of God's sovereignty, that he will not be stopped, and there are no courses in life that can thwart his path. Nothing can happen. Nothing can overwhelm his capacity to provide. And you, if you're his, you can trust in him. You don't need to know why it's good. You don't need to know how it'll work for your good. You need to know that because it's coming from God, that it will work for your good. So don't let that one just sink in the back, like just migrate to the back of your mind and then fall out of your ear. When that verse is said, remember that this is God working out his sovereign will, and he is unstoppable to do his will in your life. As Sumura observes in his commentary on this section, in summary, we can see the hand of the Lord working in all these matters, preparing David to be the future king, the prototype of the Messiah. But there's something left for us here. Remember, we talked about we need a foundation or the house is going to fall apart. Well, here's our foundation. God is trustworthy. He is fundamentally and unfailingly trustworthy. But we're supposed to be building something on that. And what's interesting to me is, as I've had the privilege of going through this time of trouble since David was started to gain Saul's suspicion, as Saul started to become leery of him and feel like he was gaining too much influence and suspect his motives and see the worst in David, as he's driven out, as he has to flee, as he ends up in the land of the Philistines. Through all this time, there are these two themes that are intertwining in this period in David's life and his trouble with Saul. God has worked on David's behalf in two distinct ways. One is delivering David from physical threats. Whether it's escaping from Saul's spear, whether it's the reconnaissance work that Jonathan did for him, the guile of his wife Michal allowing him to escape, the victory of and the subsequent escape from Keilah, the call that the Philistines were invaded that interrupted Saul's nearly successful pursuit of David in the wilderness of Maon. All of these are beautiful examples of God's protecting hand, keeping David alive, keeping him safe, keeping him well. But the other theme is David being built up in his spiritual qualifications, the development of David's character, the demonstration and the preservation of David's godly character. We see that in the incident in Engedi at the Cave of the Rocks of the Wild Goats, where he refused to take Saul's life. We see it in the intervention of Abigail, the widow of Nabal in Carmel, who stopped him from taking vengeance on Nabal's household. We see it in the opportunity he had to spare Saul, and the opportunity he took to spare Saul on the hill of Hakilah. We see that he truly is a man after God's own heart. And that's where the foundation of God's trustworthiness should be taking us. God's unfailing trustworthiness calls us to faithfully follow. God is fundamentally, unfailingly trustworthy, and God's unfailing trustworthiness calls us to faithfully follow. Based on who God has shown himself to be, we are to draw near in faith. And one of the ways that we do that is we cultivate a close personal relationship with God. When you hear the call to follow, you should be called to cultivate a close personal relationship with God. Look back there at verse 6 once again. David is distressed. The people are embittered. They want to stone him. The last phrase in that verse, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I did a little walk through the scriptures. I was curious. The Lord God is a frequent reference to God. You see that all over the scriptures. I found it 383 times in the New American Standard Bible, 1995 update edition. I went through every page of the Bible, and I looked for it, and I came up with 383. Actually, I used my computer. But then I said, well, let me look for times when the personal pronoun, when the possessive personal pronoun is inserted in there. So I looked up, and I found that the Lord, his God, is used 29 times, and the Lord, our God, is used 86 times. And the Lord, your God, 398 times. And the Lord, their God, 36 times. If you can add those in your head, Pastor John will be so proud of you when he gets back. I came up with 549 times in the New American Standard Bible. 383 times, the Lord God, 549, the Lord, their God, our God, his God. God wants to be personally known. Attention to his word, drawing near in prayer, worshiping him consistently, seeking ways to serve him in our daily lives, help to stitch the fabric of a life of faith. And we shouldn't do it just so we're ready for the crises. All right, so something bad's going to come. I better have my relationship with God nailed down, batten down the hatches, reef the mainsail. I want to be ready to go. But it helps. It helps if we're cultivating this personal relationship with God. It helps when the bottom drops out. Remember, both Saul and David sought the Lord in their time of distress. It's chapter 28 of 1 Samuel. Saul is distressed because the Philistines are coming against him, and he seeks the Lord. He reaches out to God, and David here is distressed because the people want to stone him and he's lost his family, and he calls out to God. And as I pointed out last week, those texts are not in chronological order. And Bergen actually said they may have been doing this at the same time. When Saul goes to the medium at Endor, the Philistines are already up in Shunem, camped right across the way. When David gets sent back from the Philistines and takes that three-day march to Ziklag, they're still in Aphek. They're far south. So it could have been happening at roughly the same time. David had a relationship with God. Saul didn't. 1 Samuel 28, 5-6, when Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Saul was distressed. He cried out to God. He heard nothing. David was distressed. He called out to God. God said, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all. David had a relationship with God. Saul didn't. What else does it call us as we faithfully calls us to faithfully follow? What else does it call us to? Choose encouragement in the means that God has provided. Once again, in verse 6, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I don't know exactly what that looked like, but I can't imagine it happening without some very deliberate self-talk on David's part. It called to mind for me Psalm 42:5. Why are you in despair, O my soul? And why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him for the help of his presence. I can't see it happening without David talking to his soul. I can't see it happen without David casting an eye backward on all the ways that God had cared for him up to this point, from the lion and the bear in the wilderness while he was guarding his father's sheep, to being sent back from a battle with the Israelites because the Philistines didn't like him. We have to by the grace of God, take it upon ourselves to look to him. You have to take the gift of your will. Your will is a gift. It's there to help you in the times when your emotions are not getting the job done. You have to take the gift that God has given to us of our will and decide to consider him and his ways, to pick up the Bible that we may not want to read, to get down on knees that don't want to bend, to come to a church service that may be laden with a minefield of anxiety and say, I will wait for you. I will seek you and I will wait for you because I know that you are unfailingly trustworthy. So David reached out to God through the ephod with which Abiathar had escaped from the slaughter of the priests of Nob. You know, remember, Abiathar didn't get his family back, but they all died. 85 priests, Abiathar escaped, and he brought the ephod with him. And perhaps it was by the Urim and the Thummim that were kept in a breastplate that was attached to the ephod that David used to seek the Lord, or it may have been through some other means. But he took advantage of the means that were there for him to seek God. And we have to take advantage of the means of grace that God puts at our disposal to reach out to him and to see his goodness. Cultivate a close personal relationship with God. Choose encouragement and the means that God has provided. And let God's gracious provision free you to be gracious to others. When David comes back to the brook Besor, where 200 had been left behind, he greets them. And I like Sumora's translation. He puts it this way, because the word shalom is in there in the Hebrew, in that greeting, which is not a common. We know shalom is a greeting. But Sumora puts it this way, and David approached the people and asked after their peace. And then he goes on to quote D.J. Wiseman, indicating that asking their peace could be more than a routine greeting, to show that there was no hostile feeling towards them, despite the criticism of them by those engaged in the battle. Remember, we had these wicked and worthless men in verse 22 who said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we recovered. They were like the little hen, right? Well, you didn't help me get the wheat. You didn't help me knead the dough. You didn't help me bake the bread. You don't get to eat the bread. There wasn't enough sweat equity on the part of those who stayed behind at Besor. David is quick to disagree with this wicked, worthless work ethic. There's room for a good work ethic. This is not the time or the place. Then David said in verse 23, you must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. David is gracious with this. David puts off this desire to say, they didn't fight, they don't get any stuff, give them their wife, give them their kids, and get them out of here. David doesn't agree with that because David sees all of this as coming from God's hand. And so he's free to distribute it to others. And you know what it reminds me of? The words of David's far greater son, Jesus, in Matthew 20. Would you turn there? Matthew 20, starting in verse 1. Oh, I marked it. I can just flip. Jesus said, for the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. When he'd agreed with the laborers for a denarius for the day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to those he said, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. And so they went. Again he went out about the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same thing. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day long? They said to him, because no one hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first, when those hired about the 11th hour came, each one received a denarius. When those hired first came, they thought that they would receive more, but each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they grumbled at the landowner, saying, "These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day." But he answered and said to them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go. But I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with what is my own? Or is your eye envious because I am generous?" So the last shall be first and the first last. God's gracious provision to us should free us to be gracious to others. Let the ways that he has worked on your behalf, the generosity which he has lavished on you, overflow into the lives of others without counting the beads of sweat on their forehead. This is the nature of the kingdom. And then know that there is mercy for your failures. I wondered if that line about Saul calling on God and getting nothing, and David calling on God and getting a promise that everyone would come back, I wondered how that was sitting with you and if it might be pricking your conscience. Because you might be saying, "I'm not faithful like David. I've gone too far. I'm a Saul." And so I want to key in on a word from this text and let it encourage you to remember that God will always meet the one who comes running back to him in repentance. Would you look back at verse 6? We've played that one for a lot. First Samuel 36. "Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered." That word distress was interesting to me, and as I was doing some linguistic study, there was another time that David was in distress. He's distressed here because he's about to be stoned by his own men because they're bitter. There was another time. If we looked ahead to 2 Samuel 24, you might remember the time that David wanted to number the people. He wanted to take a census, and it was clearly against the will of God, but David went and did it anyway. And so God disciplined him for it. And do you remember? God gave him three choices for his punishment. 2 Samuel 24, 10 to 14. "Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, 'I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly.' When David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, 'Go and speak to David. Thus the Lord says, I am offering you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do to you.' So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, 'Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me.' Then David said to Gad, 'I am in great distress. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man.'" You see what's happening here? When David was distressed because his wives and the families of his men had been taken, and his men were talking about stoning him, he put himself in God's hands. When David was distressed because he had sinned and God was disciplining him, what did he do? He put himself in God's hands. "Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great." The relationship persisted through the discipline. If you're his and you feel like a Saul tonight, turn toward him confess, he is faithful and just, faithful and righteous to forgive. And if you're not his, come to him. You're a sinner. You've broken God's law. You will perish eternally for it. God came down in the person of his Son, Jesus Christ, and took that punishment on the cross so that you could be forgiven. And if you come to him and say, I can't get through this myself. There's no way I can pay for this. Help me. Save me. And you understand that that means that you come to belong to him, that you will become his possession for all of eternity. He will save you. Lastly, keep deliverance on God's timetable, not yours. When I read a text like this and we talk about God's amazing deliverance, how God rescued everybody through David, he gave him victory over his enemies, I anticipate objections that rise up not only in your heart, but in mine as well. I thought about saying God is fundamentally, unquestionably trustworthy. And then I thought about saying God is fundamentally, undeniably trustworthy. And I believe both of those things are true, but here's the thing. We can deny and we can question whether God is really trustworthy. It's easy to look back and say, it's all well and good for David. He got everything back. That didn't happen for me in my devastating circumstances. Or if we're in a crisis now, we might say, I don't have the same promise that this will happen for me, that this horrible thing I'm going through, God will deliver me the way he delivered David. The only thing I can answer you is that you do have a promise. You do have a promise. And though it tarries, wait for it. Because this is what the end of the book says. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people. And God himself will be among them, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. And he said, write, for these words are faithful and true. Then he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water of life without cost. Deliverance is coming. It may come now in your situation. Don't abandon that hope. But if it doesn't come now, fix your eyes on the horizon of God's faithfulness and see the good that awaits you if you are his. Live in the light of his trustworthiness and let it guide your feet into fruitful and joyful witness and service to him. Get a handle on your foundation, then build on it by his grace. Strengthen yourself in the Lord, your God. Amen.